Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, welcome to New Books and Literary Studies on the New Books Network. My name is Kathleen DeGuzman, a host on the channel. Today I will be talking to Candace Ward. Candace is Associate Professor in the English Department at Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida. She's also the author of a new book titled Crossing the Line, Early Creole Novels and Anglophone Caribbean Culture in the Age of Emancipation, published by the University of Virginia Press just this year. Thank you, Candace, for joining me today to talk about your new book.
Oh, you're so welcome.
I thought we'd get started by asking you to describe how you came to this project, which is your second scholarly book after 2007's Desire and Disorder, which examined 18th century medical texts within sentimental culture. So was there a way in which this project emerged from that project?
Yeah, I had been looking into primarily fever narratives was the part of medical text that I was working with, and a big part of 18th century sentimental narratives, of course, deals with fever. People are always dying of fevers or suffering fevers. And as I kind of got drawn into the archives there, I noticed a lot of work had been done on tropical fevers. So a colleague of mine, I was at Illinois State University at the time, and a colleague told me or suggested to me that I should go to Jamaica, which oddly the thought had never occurred to me to do that. But I was awarded a Fulbright in 2002, and so went to Jamaica and stayed there for 7 months or so. And it was there that I just became completely infatuated with the connections between English sentimental narratives and the Caribbean colonial culture. And fortunately for me, people at the university in Kingston were incredibly generous, incredibly friendly, and pointed me in so many fruitful directions. And Norval Edwards, or Noddy Edwards, who is at the university and previously had been on the editorial board of Small Axe, he told me about a novel that I really needed to read called Hamel the Obeah Man. And I had never, ever heard of it. And so I found a copy in the National, or no, it was in the university library. It was a Xerox of an old microfilm version. So this was before I could have searched it out on Google. But I got hold of it and read it and was just completely blown away. And then he had also pointed me toward Camille Brathwaite's work, his early historical work on Creole society in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And he had also published a small article in Savaku and dealing with British literature during the period of slavery. And he mentions Hamel and a couple of other works. And so I knew I wanted to eventually write about these novels. I'm still very much focused on prose fiction of the period. And but it wasn't tied specifically to the fever desire and disorder. So I had to wait a little bit until I tackled that. And then that's how I started crossing the line.
That's such a fascinating story to go from a fever text to, I guess, the archives and to Brathwaite. And so I'd like to shift to talking about the actual book now, so Crossing the Line. Could you just tell us a little bit more about the significance of that book's title? Your intro touches upon a few key meanings that phrase had in the historical period that you cover.
Right. This was quite a fun part of the research. I was really curious. I knew I wanted to talk about crossing the line metaphorically, particularly in ways that in the 18th and up into the 19th century, people living in the metropole talked about those people who had traveled to the Caribbean as being so different, especially if they stayed in the Caribbean, as being different from metropolitan subjects. And they talked about the journey undertaken and the way that the ships would actually have to physically cross the latitudinal lines, not quite the equator at that point, but the Tropic of Cancer, for example. So this idea of crossing the line being a physical act was very, very important to me. And then the book touches on a lot of other kinds of crossings, like crossing generic lines, crossing racial lines, linguistic lines, all of these things. So I thought that the title was a kind of a natural for the study and for the work that I wanted to do with these novels. So I got to explore nautical traditions, and there are ceremonies that actually I think they still go on. If an individual is crossing one of those latitudinal lines on board a ship and they have never made that crossing before, they're kind of hazed. They have to undergo a kind of a baptism ritual, and sometimes these ceremonies are quite quite raucous. And so I read a lot of descriptions of these lines. For example, Charles Darwin had to be ducked and shaved when he crossed the equator, when he went on his, you know, journeys. And in the novels, they talk about the crossing the line ceremonies and the kinds of tensions that these rituals alleviated to some degree, because it was truly a kind of a topsy-turvy idea. It was the common sailors that were in charge of this, and officers of the ship were not protected from having to undergo this ceremony. And the saying was that there was no law as you crossed the line, that authority went out the window, and it was a time for the common folk on the ships to take charge and to be the boss. So I thought that was a really intriguing idea. And so that was kind of what led me to take on this title.
So if we could just dwell on the title a little bit more, I think the term Creole, for example, is a term that is not at all self-evident to listeners today. And I was wondering if you could just tell us what that word means, particularly in the time period that you study.
Right. In the time period, in the colonial era, and some etymologies of the term take it back to Spanish colonial sites and in the slave colonies, it referred to someone born in the Americas. So it didn't necessarily have any thing to say about a person's racial background, their ethnic heritage, but it meant to be born in the Americas. So that in the period that I write about, Creole could be a noun, it could be an adjective. You could talk about Creole ponies, for example, horses that had been descended from European horses, but by that time a strain had been bred that was local and stronger, it was thought, better acclimated to the situation. It could refer to people. you typically saw the term referring to people just simply as that, Creoles. Or it would also, you know, be carry a racial component as well. So you would have white Creoles or black Creoles or African Creoles. So, but the term itself, it just referred to the place where the subject was born or where the subject had lived for a prolonged period. Brathwaite's formulation talks about it in terms of committed settlers when it's used for white Creoles, for example. So, I think that in terms of contemporary scholarship, there's been a lot of work in the past 30, 40 years even, having to do with hybridity studies, with ideas of creolization as kind of multicultural, multiracial mixtures of people and cultures and languages. And so I felt fortunate that I could draw on both the early sense of the word and use the more contemporary sense of the word to complicate my readings of these colonial texts.
Right, right. So I want to actually go back to or build off of something that you talked about earlier when you were describing how this project developed and reading Hamel, the Obeah Man, on microfilm. And it seems that the archive of early Creole novels that you study in the book is quite a small archive. And in particular, you mentioned how Samuel Gray's 1841 novel, Old Port Royal, it's a two-volume novel, and the second volume is actually missing. So just wondering if you can just talk a little bit more about your specific archive of novels.
Right. That was one of the trickiest things that I had to work through. I know way back in the early days of the project, I had kind of chosen several works, and I knew I wanted to write about them. And then it was actually Sean Gowdy, the author of Creole America. Mm-hmm. He had very generously read a very, very early draft of my introduction, and he asked, "Well, why were there so few of these works?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, he's right. There are so few of these works. What am I going to do? What's up with this? Why are there so few of them?" And I think I was looking at it first by period. I thought, okay, I'm an 18th century scholar. I have to work with 18th century texts. And I found that too limiting. And then when I scooted up into the 19th century, I found a few other titles, but then they too were, there weren't many of these texts written. And so as I tried to grapple with the why of that small archive, and one of the things that became apparent was that even though some of the novels are written that I discuss are written after emancipation, they were in a way, and I know I'll mangle the pronunciation, romanates, thesis-driven novels. They were political novels. And the politics of these novels, especially before the Act of Emancipation, in 1830, that went into full effect in 1838, was that they were very much what one contemporary reviewer called party works. These were novels written by affiliates of the plantocracy as justifications for arguments against emancipation. So once that debate appeared to be over, there was no reason for novelist to take up the novel form to engage with the emancipation debate. So that to me explained why there were relatively few novels, written by white Creoles in this period. before emancipation. But then as I kind of scooted my, I allowed myself to kind of break the chains of my 18th century self to go into, you know, further into the 19th period, or sorry, 19th century, that even though the emancipation debate had ended with the act to, you know, full emancipation, the issues that concerned those earlier writers persisted, and writers in the Caribbean continued to talk about them through novels. So E.L. Joseph, his novel Warner Arundel is a really interesting book that deals with you know, establishing a new kind of plantocracy, one that's perceived as humane, a group of people who have put the evils of slavery behind, but still maintain their power and superiority over black and brown populations. And then you get writers like Michelle Phillips, who is himself of mixed race and who takes on the same kinds of issues that appear in the earlier novels, but from a much different perspective. So I'm not sure if I quite addressed the question about the archives, but that's a rationale for what novels that I was looking at.
Oh, you did. And that actually brings me to the next question I have about the distinct content of these novels. So in one of your chapters, your chapter on Warner Arundel, you quote from a contemporary review of the novel that describes the novel as, quote, it looks like fiction, some like truth, some like novel, some like history. So could you just talk about, I guess the crossings of genre and mode that we find in these novels?
Yeah, I think actually that particular kind of crossing is a residual way of writing from the 18th century. I think that this is one of the benefits of having read so many 18th century British novels is that the writers of works of fiction engaged in all kinds of literary output. They weren't necessarily self-identified strictly as a novelist, so they wouldn't have limited themselves necessarily. Yes, I can be engaging in a work of fiction, but some of my fiction is going to borrow from, you know, another kind of prose, so travelogue or poetry or spiritual autobiography, all of these things that took place in the 18th century novel kind of continued into the 19th century text. And in fact, E.L. Joseph's Warner Arundel is an interesting case in point in the that particular novel. I'm not sure if it's still available, if it's still in print or not. At one point, it was in print from the University of the West Indies Press, and the editors of that edition point out that on the title page, the novel itself refers to it like one of Lawrence Stern's novels, Tristram Shandy, in fact. Mm. And if you've ever read Tristram Shandy, you know that it's anything but a straightforward work of narrative fiction. There's so much going on there. And so I think that accounts for some of the crossings, generic crossings. I think another part of it had to do with the politics that these writers wanted to engage in. They wanted to instruct readers in a pleasing way. And so as the author of Marley puts it, the machinery of a novel is a really great vehicle for educating people about particular truths, and that's in quotation marks, of course.
So who would have been the readers of these novels? Would they have been other white Creoles throughout the Caribbean, or were they more addressed to the metropole?
That's I was trying to answer that question in another context, and I think that's the trickiest question of all to try to figure out. Even the books that were published in the UK, either Glasgow or Edinburgh or London, they would have been, so they, of course, would have circulated in the metropole. They also would have made their way back to the Caribbean, because you had a very lively, I'm thinking of Jamaica in particular, and I'm sure the case was the same in Trinidad and Barbados, probably in all the islands, a very lively book-selling trade there. So they would have, been shipped back to the Caribbean and sold in bookstores and printers' offices. And then in the case of Marley, that book, I mean, I'm sorry, not Marley, Montgomery, or the West Indian Adventure, the earliest of the novels that I look at, that was published in Kingston. So that definitely would have circulated among white Creole readers. And then also it would have gone back. I think I found a reference to Montgomery in a circulating library catalog. So they wanted as wide a readership as they could get, but it wasn't necessarily located on one side of the Atlantic or the other. And that holds for North American readers as well. There were reviews and allusions to these works in, say, the Philadelphia newspapers. So they made their way around.
I wanted to ask you as well how you see these novels, because I saw this as a kind of thread through some of the chapters, how you see these novels dialoguing or trying to create their own sense of history. And, I mean, going back to the broader topic of blurring generic lines and crossing lines, I mean, you know, I'm thinking of a text like Edward Long's History of Jamaica, which just seems so outlandish in certain portions, despite being a history. So what happens to that idea of history in these novels?
I think, I mean, this goes back to the notion of them, especially the earlier ones before emancipation, as being political texts. I think that these authors understood several things. They understood that that the abolitionists back in England were winning, as it were, that they were winning the PR campaign against slaveholders, and that they wanted to correct what was being said about Creole culture. And I think one of the reasons that they wanted to correct that version of events was that they have a very lively sense of history, that things are being documented, that things are being recorded, as it were. And so they wanted to assert their own kind of historical take on events. So especially when you get to a work like Warner Arundel, for example, which was published in 1838, that's the same year that E.L. Joseph, the author, published his History of Trinidad, which was that English colony's first English language history. So then he sets the events of the novel in the 1790s, which is actually a little earlier than E.L. Joseph himself even arrived in Trinidad. But so you see these connections between writing a straightforward history and writing a historical novel. And the other novels in Crossing the Line are also historical novels, you know, set in the past. And so I think there was a strong sense on the part of the authors, like, you know, most historical novelists, that fiction is a way to, say, bring history to life. And it's also a way to validate history, and sometimes in ways more effective even than a straightforward nonfiction history. And it's all tied up with impending strands of nationalism, I think, are in there as well. But I think that historical fiction played an important role in both their the defense of the older plantocracy and in establishing a new and improved post-slavery plantocracy.
Hmm. So one of my favorite lines from the introduction in your book is where you elaborate about the broader implications of this admittedly small archive of white Creole novels, and you write, quote, "The novels featured in Crossing the Line attest to the indefensibility of the white Creole position," end quote. And I mean, for our listeners out there who are most likely not familiar with any of these novels, what is the, I guess, the takeaway that present day readers would have if they were to read a novel like Hamel, the Obeah Man, or Marley?
I think what I was trying to say in that line too is that there's a way that, well, there's been an ongoing debate about, especially among colonial Caribbeanists, how do you engage with the archives? What are you doing in these archives, especially when they are produced by people who were avid supporters of a system of brutality and oppression and a horrific institution? So why do we need to bother with these works? And what I'm trying to show by looking at them and putting them in the context of life in the Caribbean colonies at the time is that they point to the kind of human elements that are at work. I'm not saying that we owe these poor white Creoles, they're so misunderstood. I'm not saying that at all. But that these writers were engaged in supporting a culture that they knew was indefensible. They knew that slavery was morally repugnant, and they had to somehow rationalize and justify their place in society, and they found writing fiction might be one way to do that. But also those kinds of strategies of rationalizing and justifying, romanticizing even, we see it today. It's just, you know, I finished this a good bit before events in Charlottesville, for example, but in the wake of Charlottesville and all the discussions about, you know, monuments and the myth of the lost cause, these were the same things. These were the same things going on with these Creole writers. So I'm trying to present them. I want readers, if they do read my book and if they feel driven to read some of these novels, I want them to say, oh, my gosh, this is exactly, you know, what's going on right now. This is precisely what's going on right now. Because it's all connected. We can't, there's no firm marker between, you know, past and present these days, not in our contemporary climate at all. So that's what I was hoping for.
Right. And I mean, there's another, I guess, thread in the book is this notion of history as revolving around not the idea of time passing, but time accumulating. And I definitely see that that continuity between these white Creole novels and, you know, our current age of ongoing white supremacy.
Right. And the idea, I mean, I think that's that of course is from Ian Balcom's Spectres of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And he kind of gives that formulation of time, but also the idea, and because I teach 18th century classes, and I'm sure you've encountered this as well as a Victorianist, it's so easy reading a 200-year-old work to say, oh, goodness, we've certainly put those ideas behind us, and that's been proven false, and so forth. And the idea, though, that these are really kinds of uglinesses that have persisted and that continue to operate in our culture, I think that's what the emphasis has to be on, that there it's not over. The history is not finished. So,
right. So I've taken up quite a bit of your time, and I'd like to begin wrapping up by asking you what you're working on now.
Yes. Well, now I'm trying to draw on the context of what I discovered in the work of Crossing the Line. The colonial subjects that I was examining didn't necessarily categorize themselves along the lines that we now in the 20th and 21st century do Caribbean studies, Anglophone Caribbean, Francophone Caribbean, mm-hmm, Hispanic mm-hmm. Caribbean. And so for my next project, I want to engage the archives to look at it as a more pan-Caribbean phenomenon. So I've been this is very early stages. I've been looking for connections between, people who saw themselves as much more Caribbean cosmopolitans. They were multilingual. There were, everyday exchanges between, islands that even if Haiti had been a French colony, it was now independent. Jamaica's an English colony, but there's lots of traffic between Jamaica and Cuba. So all these exchanges, that's what I want to explore through the print culture.
Okay, so you're not looking exclusively at novels, but at print culture more broadly.
Right, right. I'm looking at newspaper. I was able to do some work in the Montgomery chapter on newspaper offices in Kingston. And so I want to expand that and look at other printing families, for example, and networks across, the various colonial lines. So I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I mean, there's a way in which, I guess, the Caribbean archive, the standard narrative around it is that there's a lack. I mean, I'm thinking of, Derek Walcott's poem, mm-hmm. The Sea is History, but at the same time, there's also this this excess, particularly when we look at a broader idea of print culture by turning mm-hmm. to newspapers and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And one of the papers that I'm really interested in was called The Watchman and Jamaica Free Press. And that was established by two men of color, Robert Osborne and Edward Jordan. And they were publishing their newspaper right before emancipation, so 1829 or thereabouts. So here was an example of an Afro-Caribbean paper operating in Kingston with a pretty healthy circulation, in island terms, and very influential to the abolitionist activity in England through the Anti-Slavery Reporter, which would pick up columns and reporting from the Watchman and reproduce it in the Anti-Slavery Reporter. So that was something that was very exciting to me. And so I'm looking forward to follow up on that.
Yeah, because that configuration, I mean, it's the opposite of
exactly
how we typically structure the metropolitan colony.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait for that to come out, and I'm sure you're excited to, I guess, hunker back down in the archives after writing a book. Okay, so we have been talking about the book Crossing the Line, Early Creole Novels and Anglophone Caribbean Culture in the Age of Emancipation. Thank you for such a great conversation about your work, Candace, and thank you to the listeners out there as well.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.